Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. This week's show is a musical fiesta. We've got rock, J-pop, 90s revivals and even a food critic who likes to tinkle the ivories in his spare time. But who will be the life and the soul of this party? Well, it's only Will Hodgkinson, chief rock and pop critic for The Times, and the DJ and broadcaster, Georgie Rogers. They'll be joining me in the studio to tell us which of October's new releases are worthy of your ears. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Do stay tuned. Well, and Georgie, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Thank you very much.
The ice was broken beautifully in the green room. Georgie came in in full motorcycle regalia. This was a good entrance.
Looking like I've been shot out of a cannon.
Well, a bit. I kind of wanted some misted up kind of old Biggles spectacles as well.
I was just hoping it was like a classic Triumph or a BSA or something like that.
Yeah. Is something
it?
Old school.
It is. It's a Honda. Good. Yeah, it's a Honda. Yeah. It's an old Honda.
It's an old Honda.
It's a classic.
Okay.
It's not like...
It's not a 50cc.
No. 125, it's not that much bigger than that.
But
yeah, not a hog, as you
It's not a hog.
Saying.
Up next on Top Gear.
Yeah.
Top Gear was it was John Peel's original show, wasn't it? It was called Top Gear. It was John Peel's first radio.
He wasn't talking about cars.
Show. No. Should we stick
just
to the programme?
So you know.
Georgie, the first album you've chosen this week is New from St. Vincent. Should we have a little clip to get our listeners in the mood, and then we'll talk off the back of it. That is a bit of Los Angeles, new from St. Vincent, from the LP called Mass Education, as chosen by Georgie Rogers.
Mass Seduction.
Yeah, this
just,
is good.
I'm
looking at this again on my script.
It's quite easy because...
Mass Education. Mass Seduction.
It's Mass Seduction.
Mass Seduction, as I was saying, Georgie.
Yes.
It's a very different vibe to Mass Education, isn't it? Sounds like a sort of... Sounds like something Roosevelt would have talked about. Possibly.
Yeah, Mass Education, not quite the alluring, seductive thing that Mass Seduction is and that St. Vincent is putting across with this record, which, I mean, visually, she's amazing. So, I mean, just as an introduction...
Who's not in love with St. Vincent?
Who isn't in love with her? Yeah. She is smart, she's clever, she's an amazing songwriter, amazing guitarist. She's just... I can't sing her praises enough. As an introductory to this album, I got to go and sit in a pink... It was a hot pink wooden box with some other radio people. And we got to go in there and she described it like a psychedelic womb. And it was all hot pink. There was a couple of lamps in there, a table, her looking kind of like a foxy secretary and sitting there. And then we had to sign an NDA of this massive poster with these thigh-high PVC boots to say that what goes on in the box stays in the box. So
wow.
I can't diverge. But just like...
Definitely not mass... Did you learn anything? Was there any mass education?
There was some education.
Okay, but
a lot
more
of seduction.
Seduction.
Yeah, yeah. But she just, you know, from the offset of this album, everything is quite surreal, all the visual aesthetic to it. It's all, it's colours, it's PVC, it's textures, it's, you know, hanging out with a swan, a real life swan on a purple PVC couch in the video for New York. And for that video, actually, she worked with Alex Delacorte, who's a visual artist. It was his first music video, I believe. He's had installations in Vienna and New York at the Whitney Museum. And so just everything she's done, she's coming at it from this really artistic angle. And then she's also... like lyrically amazing. I mean, she would take you down in a game of Scrabble with Annie Clark.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's so clever. The way that she's
a good
presented...
advert for Texas, isn't she? As well, she's
yeah.
Kind of. She's a down. Well, I don't think she's a down home Texan, but she's a Texan. She's from the cool bit.
Yeah.
I presume.
Yeah.
Well, someone like St. Vincent, she kind of broke onto the scene. Those first two records of hers were sort of unusual, spiky, clever kind of things. She was so striking as well. It kind of helps sell the package. Mm. Where does someone like that go with this? Because this, I mean, just the little bit we heard there, Los Angeles. It's probably Los Angeles. I probably just can't read. Los Angeles. That sounds more poppy. It sounds fatter and kind of more, you know, more electronic than some of her stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this album's about sex, drugs and sadness. And she worked on it with Jack Antonoff, who is in Fun and Bleachers. And it definitely, it's kind of, it feels like quite a punchy pop record. And there's still the intricacies and the left Hetfield vibe that she brings to it. But yeah, I'd say it's more direct and maybe slightly more poppy. And then she's put out these amazing little clips on her social media of sort of like satirical clips of interview questions she'd be asked. And one of them was like, what do you think about selfies? And then she's just sitting there kind of very dryly saying, I think selfies have made it a lot easier to diagnose narcissistic personality disorder. And then there was another one. It was like, what about the inspiration for the record? And she just said, I saw a woman alone in her car singing along to Great Balls of Fire, and I wanted to prevent that from ever happening again.
I wouldn't mind that. Imagine you're stuck at a red light, Will, for example. You saw a woman in a car over yonder, seeing Great Balls of Fire.
I'd be very interested.
Yeah. I'd be interested. I'd definitely video
that. I don't want to stop that.
Yeah. No, I don't want to stop
that. I encourage it.
So she's met one of the prime concerns of this album is to make music good enough that you don't need to do that.
That you don't need to sit in your car singing Great Balls of Fire.
It's a very specific reference.
It is.
And for that, I applaud her.
Yeah. Okay. But she's just, you know, she's great. I mean, this album comes off the back of two very high-profile relationships with Cara Delevingne and Kristen Stewart. So she's she's a bigger... She's a more known face, more known person now. But, you know, I just think she deserves to be absolutely huge. And maybe this album will be the vehicle. It's five albums in. Maybe this one will kind of really break through. But I think she just manages to keep the aesthetic of her. And it's true. And it's coming from her. You can tell that she has a lot of control over the music and the look and everything. And I just think that's great.
She's an artist. Annie Clark, a.k.a. St. Vincent. Georgie Rogers says the new album is called Mass Seduction, not Mass Education. I made that really boring. thank you very much, Georgie. Well, your first choice is new from Benjamin Clementine. He's an interesting character.
He is an interesting character, and this is a very difficult album. It's called I Tell a Fly. You know, everyone remembers Benjamin Clementine from winning the Mercury in 2015 with a not particularly difficult album. This is very, very brave. I think it's very flawed as a concept because he's tackling all these things like Aleppo and the refugee crisis, and he's doing it in a very obtuse way. So it's very hard to actually get any kind of understanding about what he's trying to say about it. But at the same time, it's got all these moments of beauty. It's just very, very unusual. I can't think of anyone who's doing what he's doing. It sort of sounds like a male Edith Piaf or something.
Yeah.
Even though he's not even French. I mean, it's the whole thing is very, very original. And I think it should be applauded. It's kind of, it reminds me of the sort of albums that people used to make, especially in the sort of mid-70s, when labels would allow them to be lost leaders. You know, so they knew that it wasn't going to sell that much, but they thought this is a great artist and we've got Leo Sayer paying for, funding it. So it's a little bit like that. I mean, he's on Virgin now, you know, so it's a major label. It's just a very, very weird... unusual, you know, it's got this narrative of about two flies in love telling the story, and it's actually very difficult. I mean, there are times when fly noises come in and ruin the beautiful piano sonata.
Yeah,
so it's unique, it's pretentious.
Yeah, I found that with the first record, which I really enjoyed, there was a lot of, it was very mannered at the same time as feeling very close to the bone, very honest. I mean, it reminded me very much of Nina Simone and stuff, but it was almost mannered.
It's very
like
mannered. It's honest and dishonest, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a piece of musical theatre. You know, every single song he's putting on a different accent, sometimes really, you know, quite bad. You know, like there's a sort of bad musical moment where he goes into Cockney. You know, it sounds like an American doing a, you know, a Londoner's accent. I mean, it's not great. I tell you what it also reminds me of is David Bowie's very early albums,
long
before fame. You know, the mid-60s albums when he's doing all the Anthony Newley stuff, when he was kind of, you know, songs like Rubber Band and Love Me Till Tuesday, and he's putting on these kind of roles and he's trying to find himself. And it's a little bit like that. And I thought, well, at least someone's doing it.
Yeah.
So although I don't think this is a very easy album to listen to, and it's not, you know, it kind of straddles two worlds, being sort of having moments of beauty and then complete avant-garde without really going headfirst into either. I just think it's brave.
OK, it's called I Tell a Fly. Let's have a little slice of it. This is called Jupiter.
Back home in Jupiter, things getting harder, wishing everyone. When I made a joke about shooting stars and spoke like a true bard, said, don't play with songs.
Okay, that was a little bit of Jupiter from the new LP from Benjamin Clementine called I Tell a Fly. A flawed, not quite masterpiece, but a flawed and intelligent and interesting pop album from 2017.
A great misfire. I mean, that's okay, the nicest and most normal song on the album. You know, that you can listen to that one.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's got a great way with the melody. He's a phenomenal singer. I mean, you can tell, though, he's got melody coming out of his pores, right?
Yeah, and that one's kind of got a simple idea. I mean, that's about, artists will know, if you go to America, you have to get a visa called Alien of Extraordinary Abilities. And so he used that as the starting point for this song about an actual alien whose planet is in trouble coming to Earth. And so it's a sort of refugee metaphor, I guess. So that's kind of straightforward and you can understand that. But most of the time he's going into such abstraction that you can't. But it's an example of the fact that he's got all this talent and all this musicality, loads of ideas, and they're cramming together in a slightly awkward way, which is still interesting.
I was interested to learn, I don't know whether he still lives and works in Paris, but I believe he certainly did for his first record. And I kind of wonder whether there was a bit of that about it. The fact that he's not sort of in competition, there is no sound at least, which the British public are familiar with, that he's kind of tapping into and riffing off. He can kind of live in a, you know, now we can live in a sort of 70s Spotify world if we want to, as you said. You know, we can just listen to sort of minor work, the B-sides of Harry Nilsson, and make an entire record.
You can definitely do that. But also, I agree with you, but also if you're in Paris, you'll probably know that, you know, you can go into a bar in Paris and sooner or later there'll be like some dudes who'll rock up and start playing this kind of tasteful jazz and it's all very serious. Yeah. And then they might go into some weird avant-garde psychodrama.
Yeah.
That happens in Paris all the time and people will nod respectfully.
Yeah.
So he's in that world.
Yes, he is. I suppose he's amongst friends here.
Yeah, I mean, in England where, you know, you've got to drink 10 pints before lamping someone, it doesn't go down so well.
It is called I Tell a Fly. It's new from Benjamin Clementine, as recommended by Will Hodgkinson. Now let's give our reviewers a break while we hear from the renowned food critic Jay Rayner. He may be famous for his newspaper columns or his TV appearances as the MasterChef judge, but it's lesser known that he's also a jazz pianist and has just released an album. The jazz album was recorded in the West End and features monologues from Rayner about two key themes in his life: food and drink, and growing up with his mother, Claire Rayner, who used to be an agony aunt and sex columnist. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Jay Rayner here at Midori House.
Exciting, isn't it? So some of you may know that I make part of my living as a restaurant critic. And you probably assume it's all gravy. And there is quite a lot of gravy.
There is a brilliant venue in Brasserie Zadel. So Brasserie Zadel is probably the best Parisian brasserie outside Paris and possibly inside Paris too. And it's located in Piccadilly Circus. It's a big basement site. But they've always had this beautiful round room, which they use a cabaret spot called the Crazy Cox. And I kind of regard it as home. A lot of the real advances as a group, as an ensemble, happened there. It's tiny. It seats only 80 people. It is perfect for this kind of music. There is nothing to beat a great night at the Crazy Cox. And so we recorded it in two shows, back to back, in March. And we did it with the knowledge that if it wasn't good enough, we wouldn't release anything. So the fact there's an album is an absolute delight.
It means it was good.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about the songs, you know, of course you did mention food and drink and quite a few of them, including one of my favourite Ladies Who Lunch.
Ladies Who Lunch, anybody who knows the work of Stephen Sondheim, it's from the musical company. Stephen Sondheim is a complicated guy for jazz because he is a very, very controlled composer. It's very tight, and jazz musicians don't like tight. We like to be able to move around. But I reckon there was a way through this. Now, I should go back a little way and say that my musical experience is not vast. As in, I didn't go to music college. I went to university. I am self-taught in various things, harmony and so forth. But arrangement I'm not bad at. And I kept looking at Ladies Who Lunch, which is a satirical view of the ladies of Manhattan, the rich ladies going from their classes in art to to their book reading groups and their charitable event, the Ladies Who Lunch in their hats, just struck me as a brilliant one for us. And I think our singer does a spectacular job with it.
I'll drink to that. Here's to the girls who stay smart. Aren't they a gas? Running
Your singer has a lovely voice as well. And tell us a bit more. You guys have a connection.
Yeah, we do have a connection. I mean, obviously, I'm biased. So the singer, when people say, "Where did you find your singer?" I found her in bed. Pat Gordon Smith and I have been married to each other for 25 years. Now, this could be a cringe-worthy thing, but she's been singing probably longer than I've been playing, although she's actually an academic publisher. And on and off, we've experimented with various things musically. But, you know, she's trained with some of the biggest names in vocal jazz in the UK, like Leanne Carroll and Ian Shaw and Claire Foster. And in many ways, I think it's what makes this, I use the term act sometimes in a kind of vaudeville way, this act work. Because, one, you cannot fake that chemistry on stage. She is my wife. And this must be said, it's a live recording and we are trying to capture a moment of what our show is like. And so you get that badinage between a couple who know each other very well. But then also musically, it meant that I could sit at home, choose a tune that I thought would be interesting, and then call Pat in and say, "What do you think of this?" And she might say, "Yes, brilliant," or "Not in that key," or "I will never sing that song as long as there is breath in my lungs," at which point I know to abandon it. But we could get a very long way with the arrangements before we came anywhere near Robert Rickenberg on bass, Dave Lewis on sax, the two long-standing musicians who work with us.
Yeah, the rest of the quartet, as yeah. I was going to ask. And it's been said that one another inspiration for the album was your mother.
Well,
that's quite an interesting story.
I'll tell you what, my confidence as a pianist has grown over the time that I've been in the quartet. But going right back to the beginning, the one thing I knew I could definitely do, rhythm pianist, not necessarily lead, but patter between, stories between, coming up with a full narrative. If jazz has been set back by anything, it's the seriousness and earnestness of some of its proponents who are going to go, "Oh, I've just written this chart based on a 1947 recording band." And it's dull. I like telling stories. That's what I do. So on the one hand, I knew I had stories to tell about food. I've been a food journalist, a restaurant critic, whatever you want to call me, for 18 years. But on the other hand, my mother was a very well-known British agony aunt, sex advice columnist. She's been dead 7 years now. I never used to talk much about her for fear of people thinking I got where I am through nepotism. The gag I tell on the album, the clean version is, though, why having a mother who is an expert in cystitis should get you a job on MasterChef, I don't know. Slightly filthier version in the actual show. And those stories are too good not to tell. Plus, and here's the key thing, so many great blues songs sound like a letter to an agony aunt.
Yeah.
If you think of, you know, the tune that Frank Sinatra called the ultimate drunk song, "One for My Baby." That's a guy in a bar, laying out his heart. He's been in love and it's all gone wrong. We'll have one more drink for the road.
Yeah.
Or Black Coffee, which manages to combine both food and drink and agony. I think you need to know why you're there and why you're doing your tunes, why you've got the audience to pay to come and hear you, and that's my thing.
The J. Rayner Quartet album, A Night of Food and Agony, is out now. Hopefully that's not a self-titled review. Jay will also be performing at London Jazz Festival at Chelsea's Cadogan Hall in November. You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bounds, and I'm currently in the studio with Will Hodgkinson, chief rock and pop critic for The Times, and the DJ and broadcaster Georgie Rogers, who both have a bit more music up their sleeves for us. Georgie, your second choice today is these two rockers team up for a new duet album. It's Courtney Barnett and Kurt Vile.
Yes.
So much to love on this record.
So much. This is like an indie music lover's duet of dreams. Mm. This, them coming together, it just seems so right. They've been longtime friends and fans of each other's work. They're both kind of, yeah, troubadours in their own right, really. And they have a very kind of similar tone of phrase, style, kind of wry sense of humour and way of storytelling. So this album is just like they could be the same person. Just their vocals like seamlessly weave in and out of each other's. The guitars are pretty like bluesy and grungy for the most part, but then there's other moments where it's sort of fingerpicked acoustic style on Continental Breakfast.
I love that. Yeah, it's a really nice one.
Yeah, kind of a ballad about cherishing intercontinental friendships over Continental Breakfast.
She's Aussie, he's from Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
She's from Melbourne, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I wonder how they made this record. This sounds very much like it was done in a studio. It wasn't email me a bit of your song and I'll put it together with my song.
Yeah, it definitely sort of feels like just quite a loose. Like they were in the studio, they just laid it down in a very natural kind of way.
I know that planes exist. So I wonder how they made this album. They live in different countries. So how is this possible?
How did they get together for
I don't understand, and I won't understand.
And they roped in some other cool peeps as well. Stella Mosgawa from War Paints on it. And then other colleagues, Mick Thomas and Jim White of the Dirty Three. And it's just kind of this sort of very conversational record. It's sort of like a stream of consciousness of just two friends. And it sounds great, nice and concise, 9 tracks.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I like that too.
Yeah.
That's something to like. Should we have a little bit of it?
Yeah.
Should we give our listeners a taste? This is a track called Over Everything.
When I was young, I liked to hear music blaring, and I wasn't caring. The new to my jams are the earplugs. But these days I inhabitate a high-pitched ring over things. So these days I plug them up.
When I'm struggling with my songs, I do the same thing too. And I crunch them up in headphones, cause why wouldn't you? You could say I hear you on several levels at heart.
That is a little slice of a new record from Courtney Barnett and Kurt Vile that's called Loss of Sea Lice.
Yes.
For some reason.
Loss of Sea Lice. I'm not quite sure why, but I mean, the lyrical content of this record
I've been
record
thinking about
really
it quite
nice.
A lot. I've had this record on in the background quite a lot and reviewed it for a magazine and stuff. Can't make head nor tail of the title.
Me neither.
No idea. But no. I kind of like it.
I think it's probably sitting around and smoking
getting really high.
Yeah,
exactly.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what it is.
It's a stoner album.
It's probably like sort of, it's something a bit like Jar Wobble, isn't it? How he got his name. It's basically someone misheard the name John Wardle or something like that, right? It's like that. I love the structure of these songs. They seem so structureless, but they kind of feel almost
very skilled,
like a barn
though.
That's just about to fall over but looks beautiful because it's so dishevelled.
Yeah, which is so hard to do, to make an effortless. It's so effortless. And it's really nice, just kind of colourful imagery and in the lyrics. Like in Untogether, the final track, and I don't know if you picked up on, there was some kind of lyrics of being shipwrecked with a frog who's endlessly testing their faith and ignoring him, and then strapping on boat feet and surfing him to shore. And I don't know, it's just like, and then like kind of ones of like property as well. It's like, I walk like a bruised ego along shorefront property unknown to me, but I'm feeling inferior on the interior, don't you see? Just like really nice way of using language.
And they scan, the way those lines scan as well, they're kind of running out of line to for their words to fit into. I'll just put it on the next line.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful. I feel like some of those
cascading kind of thing of just words and it's a really beautiful record.
It is a beautiful record. I think we're all in agreement with that.
Absolutely love it. I like both of them separately. When I first discovered Kurt Vile, he reminded me of the kid at the back of the class who's always drawing away and doesn't talk to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, hiding behind a curtain of hair.
Yeah.
And Courtney Barnett, I saw her a couple of times and she just got better and better. And the last time I saw her, she's just such a rocker. She was like Joey Ramone, you know, and she's really, I just think she is like hearing the Velvet Underground in like 1969, you know, when they were just a touring rock and roll band. I felt that that's the world that she fitted into, and she's just great. So the two of them, I think, you know, what you're saying about how they have this very effortless way of being very skilled.
Yeah.
I think that's the great thing. So it's, it is incredibly laid back, it's languid, it's enjoyable, but at the same time, if you analyse it, what's going on is not easy.
No.
You know, and they cover all that up. It's just like great footballer or something, you know, it just makes it look easy.
Yeah.
They wear their learning very lightly indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, we love that. That's Courtney Barnett and Kurt Vile. The album is called A Lot of Sea Lice. I mean, that is out next Friday, 13th of October, on Marathon Artists. I don't know why I said that when I didn't say it for any of the other ones. No continuity in this programme. I haven't thought it through. Well, your last pick is something from those lovely crate diggers at Light in the Attic, Acetone.
Acetone.
Yeah.
Acetone were a band who were around in the early 90s. Through to the early 2000s, and they were criminally overlooked. They were a huge influence on people like Spiritualized. Even Noel Gallagher cited them. The Verve loved them. And they were massively ahead of their time. They're doing this kind of, again, very, very laid-back sound, slightly tropical, kind of woozy, which is now you're hearing all the time. People like Mac DeMarco are doing it.
Yeah.
At the time, nobody was interested. They got absolutely nowhere. They were signed to Neil Young's label. He had his own label, Vapor, at the time. So everything was in place. Famous fans loved them. They had Neil Young backing them. But just nobody was interested. They didn't go anywhere. And they made a handful of records which just didn't sell. It ended in tragedy. They're a three-piece, and their bassist and lead singer, Richie Lee, killed himself. And it's taken this long, really, for them to be sort of rediscovered. And Light in the Attic are also publishing a book by an LA writer called Sam Sweet, who's told the story of Acetone through the story of all the sort of hidden corners of LA, or rather the sort of, you know, the stoplights that you end up at in Los Angeles, yeah, which are just between places and you don't think about, and there might be a dry cleaners on the corner or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's gone to all those places and sort of done this almost psychogeographical comparison of Acetone, the band that slipped through the cracks, and created this sound which is so redolent of Los Angeles. And he's related it to the sort of the dead spaces in the city, which, you know, the spread out city where...
I love the idea of that.
Yeah, it's great.
LA's such a good city for that as well, right?
It is, and but it's away from the glamour. There's nothing... Yeah. It's not about the glamour. It's about this kind of in-between land that they captured in their sound, and Sam Sweet has captured in his writing. And I've been obsessed with this. I completely missed them.
Yeah.
I was, like, just going to university at the time. I should have been...
So what were they? They were early 90s.
Early 90s. Yeah. And, yeah, you know, I should have... This is exactly the kind... I was into a lot of bands similar to this. I'd never heard of them. I completely missed them. And it's only recently that I discovered them. And this compilation, I really hope, puts them back on the map.
Let's hear what these guys sound like. This is Acetone, and the track is called All The Time. Well, you can hear why Neil Young dug them back in the day, right? They sound like that wonderful sort of creaky soul. They're like dust being blown off a Stradivarius.
On the
there,
beach,
right?
Yeah, on the beach.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of
it's
sound.
It's very on the beach, yeah.
Very on the beach. They were so good. And I think they were probably, you know, you've got to remember, 92, this was grunge. Mm. Everything, you know, in America, it's all about angst. And, you know, and this was a band who were not about angst. They were about reflection and introspection, and they did not fit in at all. So it's like, it's really interesting when you have a band. The Velvet Underground were the same. You know, you have a fantastic band who just didn't fit at the time, and the mood was against them.
It's such a funny one. What do you both think as kind of as music writers to have that? There's a bit of responsibility, isn't there? Because people are being missed every day. Possibly less so, I don't know. Maybe there's kind of less stuff coming out, or the things that are really good, a consensus can form around them a little quicker and easier these days. But it must be gutting, you know?
It's the same.
Do you think it is?
There's a great band who've been around for 10 years, who are still tiny, called Trembling Bells. And they are doing incredible string band style, folk rock, psychedelic.
Yeah.
No one's interested, you know. Yeah. I mean, people just don't like that sound at the moment. Personally, I love it.
I love it.
I think it's great. But you know, maybe a sort of 15 years ago when Devendra Banhart and Joanna Newsom were emerging, there's an appetite for it. But at the moment, the mood is elsewhere. But they keep on doing great albums. So I don't think it has changed that much. The access has changed. But now we're in a sea of access. And so, you know, getting heard in the you know, the millions upon millions of tracks that are out there, you know, just available to everyone, is difficult in a different way. So, you know.
And also, like, labels aren't taking so many risks to put the money behind the kind of long-term career artists.
That's
as
really
well.
True.
So, yeah, you know, there's so much more pressure, I think, on artists that you have to cut through, and it has to be of the
immediate
moment. And, yeah.
I mean, that's the sad thing now. You know, a band will come along and they'll get a lot of hype. The album comes out, it doesn't sell, and if they're on a major, it's bye-bye.
Yeah.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? You see people, even people that are kind of like third on the bill on a festival, and then the next year you just don't know what they're doing. You kind of look them up and they're playing sort of the Pavilion in Portsmouth. That's so big. Do you know what I mean? Or something like that. It's funny, isn't it? It's really... Guilfest. Classic. Yeah. We're back to Acetone quickly before we close up shop. How does it appear? Is it a kind of... Is it three CDs of everything they did, or is it?
It's a single CD of their quieter moments. Acetone weren't all, you know, the sound that you just heard is typical of the compilation, and it's really the best side. But, you know, there are interesting things going on. So the two surviving members have teamed up with Hope Sandoval of Maddie Star.
Oh,
Maddie
wow.
Star.
I love her.
She's great. And they're doing a concert in Los Angeles in November, and there are plans afoot. This is a slight early warning, but there are plans afoot to do a Barbican concert next year, and getting a whole bunch of people, you know, they had big fans. And so there could be some really interesting people, you know, taking that vocal role. doing a kind of acetone special. And so I just really hope that people discover this band, because I think they had a magic.
It is Acetone, new and old as ever, from Light in the Attic Records. Well, that sounds fantastic. Thank you very much for recommending that. It's called All the Time, by the way, that Acetone best of. George and Will, thank you very much for your picks today. We'll come back to you in just a moment for this week's Global Countdown. But we're going to press pause on the music for a moment while we head to London's South Bank Centre. The institution's 11th London Literature Festival opens on the 13th of October with a particularly strong lineup this year, from the likes of Tom Hanks to Hillary Clinton. The festival has World on the Brink as its main topic this year, with a strong Nordic literature focus too. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the festival programmer Ted Hodgkinson.
Really, it starts with the love of the work. It starts with reading the books and starts with believing that there is a real importance to that person coming and sharing it with a large group of people. It's a real privilege to have a space like the Royal Festival Hall to program into, because, you know, you can reach such a large number of people. Really, it's about a year in advance, maybe even more, that you start thinking about, you know, who are the people who are going to help us think about these themes? You know, South Bank Centre, we often like to approach things through a theme, because we really think it helps to tell a story of what's going on. And very often you can select a theme that is partly inspired by writers who are helping us think about this. So World on the Brink feels to me like a theme that chimes with so many of these writers we've been talking about. You know, Karla Knausgård explores that in a personal realm. Rebecca Solnit explores that in a much more broad political, socio-political realm. You know, there are writers who are exploring that in an imaginative way, like Philip Pullman. You know, the universe of his Dark Materials is a world on the brink. So I think if you get the theme right, suddenly it kind of magnetizes and everything rushes towards it and it feels very cohesive. We really believe in the idea that stories, that words can help us reimagine the state of the world. And that's really key for us. We want to explore the potentials of literature, the way that stories can change our perception of things. Last night we had Margaret Atwood at the South Bank Centre, and she's another writer who we adore and are really delighted to welcome back to South Bank Centre. And she said that she was very sorry, first of all, that her books had so accurately predicted the present. But she also said, you know, the future is not inevitable. The future can be changed. And if you think and act and imagine and even vote accordingly, the world can be changed. And that's really the fundamental principle that we work on. We really try and say literature is a space in which we can reimagine the world around us.
This year, I believe the Nordic countries play a big role in the festival. Can you tell us a bit more?
Absolutely. So as you know, Nordic Matters has been running across the South Bank Centre year. And this theme, World on the Brink, is really key for the Nordic countries. And it's partly why we're looking at it. Nordic writers are, for many, many generations, have been finely attuned to the ebbs and flows of the natural world. You know, they come out of traditions and indigenous communities that are very, very aware of their natural surroundings, from the Sami community in the north of Scandinavia to the island communities of the Faroe Islands to the Greenlandic and Icelandic territories of lunar landscapes and ice sheets. So, you know, they're places that are really shaped by their natural environments. And they're also places that have often been at the forefront of progressive change when it comes to climate change. So we're looking at a whole spectrum of Nordic writers. We have some of the finest writers from the region. We have Sophie Oksanen, Jonas Hassan Kamiri, Han Austervik, writers who maybe are really celebrated in literary terms, but we'd like them to have a broader audience as well. So we're really keen to support them and present them to a literary audience. The other thing we're doing as well to make sure that there's an artifact to go with all of this festival planning is actually an anthology, the first anthology of its kind, which is a selection of short stories that I've edited with Sion, the Icelandic writer, which gathers together stories from across the Nordic region. This is the first time anyone had done this. And it's quite interesting because sometimes the idea of Nordic identity might seem like a recent thing. But Sion actually really strongly believes that the Nordic countries share these very deep, strong roots that are based in mythology, based in storytelling, based in religion, based in landscape as well. And there are literary connections, and those come out. The stories are full of surrealism, they're full of wit. Those mythic traditions lie very close to the surface in Nordic countries. So it's really wonderful to be able to present an anthology that goes with the festival that people can take away with.
And another one of the big names is also, I believe he's from Norway, Karl Ove Knausgård. Will he be at the event as well?
So I'll be interviewing him in the Royal Festival Hall, and I'm really excited about that. He's... he's a writer who, as you know, has sort of changed the DNA of the novel almost. He's had such a radical impact on the way people conceive of the novel, with his extraordinary candor and frankness and depth and lateral moves between art and his family, and the depth of the psychology he achieves in those books is quite extraordinary. And the new series of seasonal books as well, so we'll be talking about those. And yeah, I mean, he's someone who has really, he's become in a way the kind of rock star of Nordic literature, and you know, we want there to be space for rock stars in the festival too.
That was Ted Hodgkinson, Senior Programmer for Literature and Spoken Word at the South Bank Centre, and the London Literature Festival begins on the 13th of October, and you can get your tickets at southbankcentre.co.uk. Now, as always, rendering the show with the global countdown, and spinning the globe this week is Monocle's very own Bill Lutie. Bill.
Hi.
Hi, Bill. Where are you taking us this week?
I normally like to go somewhere different. But okay. It's really hard to find the top five of those places. So this week,
when you say different, what do you mean? Like sort of Mozambique?
Yeah, somewhere really, okay. Try and get really obscure.
Yep.
But this week we're going to Japan.
Okay, I've heard of that.
You've heard of it.
Done
you've been
that.
There.
Yep.
And it's a really decent top five this week.
Is it?
Yeah.
Talk us through it. So Namie Amuro and Hiro is number five.
She is like the queen of K-pop. She's been doing it for 25 years. And about 2 weeks ago, shock.
Okay.
She announced her retirement.
Oh, no.
On the 16th of September 2018. She will stop music forever.
That's a really funny date, isn't it? This is if she's actually got a cut, she's kind of winding down a company.
I think it's going to be like the anniversary, her like 25th, or this year is her 25th year, and then that will be the end.
Right. It'll
be the beginning of her 26th year, she's quitting. To mark that, she's releasing a 3-CD best of, which is going to include 39 re-recordings of her old classics, 6 new songs. It's got 52 tracks on it. It's going to be absolutely massive. She's doing 5 stadium dates in Japan.
What's her vibe? What's Namie Amuro's vibe?
Well, listeners to the Monocle 24 playlist, Rob, such as yourself, will know she's got some excellent tracks, like Hot Girls Make the World Go Round.
Brilliant. Okay, well, who's to argue with that?
It's just J-pop. It's just great J-pop, but like
Hot
she's
Girls
kind
Make
of...
the World. Is that really what it is called?
Yeah. I'd Brilliant. Actually think of it as a feminist anthem, but... Maybe.
Yeah, okay. You might be wrong. Okay, so Namie's... So she's banging out on the 16th of December. We shed a collective tear, I think, around the table.
Yeah.
What do we also think about re-recording all your songs for a Greatest Hits album? I'm not into that much.
Bad idea.
Weird, isn't it?
Yeah, they're never
Imagine
as good.
Imagine if Bob Dylan recorded Highway 61 Revisited now.
He probably would. With a swing band.
Yeah. Right, it's a funny one, isn't it? I don't know.
Like those songs already exist. If you want to listen to the originals, you can go back and listen to them, or you can listen to these terrible rehashes.
Okay.
It's like... Well, it's reselling it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Namie bows out on the 16th of December.
September.
September.
Mm.
But next, was it
next
October?
Year, next year.
Oh, right, okay. Sorry. Oh,
so she's given a long lead up. So she's like, hey, I'm going to quit, but in a whole year's time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like
she's
the farewell tour.
Change
her
mind. Between now and then.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Okay. Gen Hoshino and Family Song.
Yeah, this song.
Terrible name for a song.
It's a really bad song. It's a really bad song name, but it's an excellent song.
Is it?
Yeah, it's like proper old school pop. There's like nice string sections in the background.
A bit of Bacharach.
Yeah, it is. Okay. It really is. The video is kind of weird. It's just him and his bearded bandmates dressed up as like old ladies in a big pink house. I can't work out.
Sure.
How and then you relates. Woke up and it was all a dream.
Yeah, but the song is excellent. And the band, this guy is also in another band, which I think is worth noting, called Sake Rock. And they are inspired by Martin Denny. Do you know Martin Denny?
Yeah.
So they kind of take inspiration from him, but they do like old traditional Japanese melodies with like rock and pop kind of twist.
A Hawaiian, presumably, with Martin Denny.
I think, and then there's like a trombone and a marimba in there and other things like that. I don't know what their relation to him is, but I think they like him. And it sounds a bit, that's pretty good as well, so I can recommend checking Sake Rock out.
I'd just like to say for our listeners, everyone around the table here is kind of making a what? A kind of what?
Yeah, they are. They don't. People
no,
aren't
no, but
into
in
that.
A good way, because you're telling people things they didn't know already, which is nice. which is true of all of our guests, but I think this is particularly, I don't know if it's enlightening, but unusual.
Mm.
And confusing.
And quite confusing, isn't it? Okay, Happiness Gold.
This one. It's okay.
Yeah.
Happiness are a girl band, and what they've done is take a little bit of every song ever and put it into this song. So they've got like the panpipes of like all pop songs today. Yeah. They've got that, you know, that in that Beyonce Run the World song, they've got that breakdown where it's like, there's one of them in there. It's like a big pick a mix of today's pop.
Okay. It's called Gold, so that's fighting talk.
Yeah, it's okay.
So Yoko Oginome is Dancing Hero. She's number two.
She's number two, and this song is interesting. I clicked on it and was like, oh my God, this is like so 80s. Like, why have they tried to do that? They haven't even taken it on. I looked up. It was released in 1985. So no wonder it sounds 80s.
That's funny, isn't it?
Why is it back now?
Interesting, because
could you not
asking.
Read the website?
The Osaka Tomioka High School Dance Club recently won a national dance competition dancing to this song, and everyone was like, oh my God, I remember that. That was great. Went out and bought it in their droves, and now it's number two in the chart. It's just, for some reason, it's gone viral, and it's back. That is a really good song. I can recommend getting back into that one. It's like, it's got like orchestra hits in it. There's like giant drum fills. Pretty good.
Pretty good stuff. Who is Yoko Oginome? Is she young or old?
She's 48.
Right, yeah.
So I think she's like saw what was happening and kind of like nudged it along a bit, got out there and started doing a bit more press for it.
Okay.
But yeah, great. She's just like the original J-pop singer, I guess.
Not Namie Emuro.
No, I think Namie Emuro takes... There are two legends of J-pop in the chart.
So let's talk us through number one. Take it away, Bill. Who is number one in Japan this week?
This is the...
It's not funny.
...well-named Daoko with Kenji Yonizu with Uchiagi Hanabi.
That is the beautiful sound of Daoko times Kenji Yonezu, and it's called Uchiagi Hanabi. I don't know what that means, but...
Neither do I. But, so these are just two solo artists that have been doing really well in Japan. They've come together, written this all right song, released it. It's been in the top... It's been number one for like 5 weeks. Don't know why it's doing so well.
That was a bit of a perfunctory reading of the number one single. I think you like Gen Hoshino more.
That song is so good.
Doesn't he? He loves that. The Martin Denny people.
See you love that.
The people dressed as old ladies in a pink house, which is clearly... I'm going to look that up.
Shall I just lie and say that's number one instead?
I think you've been hanging out with Kurt Vile and Courtney Barnett. In a good way.
The video to this one's good. It's like anime. Those two people are like put into this anime love story, and there's loads of wind turbines, and then fireworks go off. There's probably, I think they're in love.
I like the string stabs in that number one song though. That's kind of good. A bit kind of like Walking on Broken Glass, Annie Lennox, kind of punchy synth strings.
Yeah, it's good. It's okay.
Okay, good.
That's not very good. That's not a very...
No, I like it. It's good. I think it's good to come in. And yes, you're saying these are five songs, you might want to check them out on the internet, you know, and you might want to purchase them possibly. Mm. But I like the way you haven't been sold down the river by any press release here. You've essentially kind of said they're not. Some of them are. One of these five songs is okay, and I think, you know, that's... I presume all five of them are on our playlist, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean they should be. I'm gonna get again Hoshino on there right now.
Can we have them in the studio? Can we have them do a session here at Midori House?
I'll ask. I'll get in touch.
I think, and we'll just mock up these studios. This is a big pink house. St. Vincent can come. It'll be wonderful.
Oh yeah.
We have found a denouement. I wondered how we were going to tie up the strings at the end of the program. That brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you, Bill Lucy, for your Japanese top five, and thanks to my guests Georgie Rogers and Will Hodgkinson, of course, as well. The show is produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I've been Robert Bounds. To play us out, let's have some of that number one. This is Daoko and Kenji Yonezu. Thank you very much for tuning in.